Are you ready to make the most of your oil and gas mineral rights? Welcome to the Mineral Rights Podcast. Get the knowledge and resources you need to manage your minerals and royalties. Here is your host, Matt Sands.
Hello and welcome to the Mineral Rights Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Sands, and I'm here to help you make the most of your mineral rights and royalties. And my co-host, Justin Williams, is here as well. Hey, Justin.
Hey, good morning, Matt.
So we're going to talk about mineral rights news for May of 2022. And Justin, I think there's a pretty interesting variety of articles this month, you know, from cities looking to purchase mineral rights to prevent oil and gas development. We got some pore space. We have a deep dive on why oil companies can't be increasing production as much or as fast as they'd like, and, you know, kind of everything in between. So before we get into those articles, I thought there was a really cool editorial video, and we'll link to that in the show notes and play a clip here, and just from Steve Forbes on Forbes.com.
When it comes to producing a sustainable and plentiful supply of energy, the U.S. has a huge and utterly unappreciated advantage over other nations. Here, individuals and companies are allowed to own mineral rights. In other countries, you can have land, but governments own and strictly control any minerals such as oil, gas, coal, copper, silver, and so on beneath the surface of your property. If you discover oil in your backyard, sorry, you're out of luck. It belongs to the government. This has profound implications that are usually overlooked. In the U.S., it means people and private companies have a strong incentive to search for minerals. They can profit from the discovery, development, and extraction of these natural resources.
And Justin, I thought he brought up a really interesting point about the situation we're in the U.S. in terms of our advancement of innovations like hydraulic fracturing, horizontal drilling, and the shale revolution are really due to the private ownership of mineral rights, which is really unique to the United States and only a certain part of Canada. So what did you think about that?
You know, he's absolutely correct. And I think it's interesting, if you look at the international landscape, you know, many of the companies, Saudi Arabia, they have state-owned oil companies. And then, you know, you're constantly hearing about the trouble for them to scale up quickly, the trouble in the management of the companies. And so within the United States, where we have the private ownership, it certainly helps competition and, you know, those private companies to get out there and innovate in a way that you just can't with state-owned oil companies.
Yeah, I mean, you incentivize them. They have some skin in the game, so to speak. They benefit from those advancements in terms of, you know, the ownership of the minerals and leasing those minerals and getting favorable terms, you know, on those leases. So the private companies benefit greatly from drilling a well in the United States as compared to, you know, certain terms that are dictated by state actors. You know, like you mentioned, Justin, if you go to almost anywhere else in the world, or really anywhere else in the world, you're negotiating with the government in terms of leasing the minerals and in going and developing, and there's all sorts of restrictions and requirements. And so really interesting point, I think, that often gets forgotten about around the implications of this private ownership of mineral rights in the U.S. is because of the incentive structure that it sets up for companies to innovate and to benefit from that innovation. And made an interesting analogy between the United States and Mexico, and certainly parts of like South Texas and stuff like that. He said, well, in Mexico, the geology is not really that much different. However, Mexico is only like a blip on the radar when it comes to oil and gas production, whereas the United States is the world's largest producer of oil. And, you know, the reason that he gives for this, it is directly related to that private ownership of minerals. And, you know, innovators like George Mitchell going into Barnett Shale, doing the first kind of combination of horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing to sort of kickstart the shale revolution and all of the stuff that has brought in terms of energy independence and economic benefit for mineral and royalty owners here in the U.S., as well as, you know, private companies that are doing this work. So I think it's a really interesting story. It's a really cool editorial. So we'll link to that in the show notes. Definitely encourage everyone to give it a listen, because I think it does talk about, you know, too, clean energy and, you know, the next steps in this energy transition and innovation that'll require around CO2 sequestration and clean hydrogen and all these things, I think that, you know, the U.S. is really set to lead the way, again, because of that, those private property rights that we enjoy.
Absolutely. And it'll be interesting to see if, as we move towards clean energy, if that continues to play a big part in the rate at which we can innovate.
That's right. So here's a quick clip, but definitely go and listen to the whole video. And, you know, really important topic there. So, okay, Justin, do you want to take us to the next article?
Let's do it. So, not so pro oil and gas for the next one here, but Fort Collins City Council mulls on an unusual path for permitting oil and gas development. And Matt, you know, this is something we hear pretty often from some of the towns surrounding Denver. And the article goes on to say that one way or another, Fort Collins City Council is interested in limiting oil and gas activity as much as possible in the city's boundaries and growth management area. And it talks about that there's questions around how exactly it is that they're going to do this. And it mentions that they're considering buying all of the mineral rights, which, Matt, it just seems a little unreasonable, and be interesting to see where this shakes out.
Yeah, they're taking every approach. I think they were looking at putting together regulations that would ban drilling in city limits. Most other cities or municipalities that have gone that route have found that it's unconstitutional. So I would expect that Fort Collins would have a tough time banning that per se. But one of the things that was floated in a city council work session in March was, what if they bought all the mineral rights in Fort Collins? And I don't think they quite understand the full implication of that, the cost, and then as well that it probably wouldn't really stop oil and gas development. But, you know, it'd be interesting that to see the conclusion they reach. It's still being studied. And one of the things that they were looking at is if they were to buy that, you know, would that allow them to stop development? And I would say, unless they owned 100% of the minerals within a drilling spacing unit, or a majority of the minerals within a drilling spacing unit, to where they would be able to prevent being force pulled, that would be the one situation where they could potentially block development, I suppose. The trouble with that, though, is they would, I think, be opening themselves up to a takings claim potentially from those other mineral owners within that area that would like, you know, development to occur and would like the value to be preserved of their minerals. And so I think they would have potentially a hard time doing that. The other thing too is that the issue is that, you know, if they buy the minerals under Fort Collins, and maybe that is one section of land, well, companies are drilling 3-mile lateral horizontal wells, so three sections are pooled together. So unless they started to buy minerals surrounding Fort Collins, but not under the city limits. And I think they're going to find that they really couldn't afford to do that. You know, I think one of the city council members acknowledged that the price for minerals could be upwards of $10,000 per net acre. So I think they'll find that they're talking, you know, more money than they have in the city budget if they're looking to go that route. One of the other interesting things that was talked about in here in this article is the setback requirements. And so, and this is in Colorado, Fort Collins, Colorado. Colorado instituted a 2,000-foot setback from homes, parks, schools, hospitals, and kind of basically residences. And what that means is that operators can't come in and drill a well closer than 2,000 feet from an existing facility or occupied structure. Now they were looking at, what if we did a reverse setback, which I actually am in favor of. I think that we should hold developers to the same standard that we're holding oil and gas companies, because the issue I think that we're getting into now with this, you know, residential areas being in close proximity to oil and gas is the fact that, you know, certainly in Weld County and the Denver-Julesburg Basin in Colorado, oil and gas has been produced from that area for, you know, 50 to 70 years. So it's nothing new. What's new is the massive population growth we're seeing and new housing developments that are being built up against these existing oil and gas facilities. And, you know, if we had the same setback requirement to where you had to have a 2,000 foot buffer for someone to put in a new hospital or a new home or a new school, then I think a lot of these conflicts could be avoided. So I think we ought to be imposing those same requirements on developers. Now, interesting that the city council recognized that, and they said, if you do a reverse setback on a development that's under construction now, you could really be open to a takings claim. And this particular city council member said, I would file a takings claim. Well, what they don't realize is by doing some of these things with respect to limiting mineral development, is they could also be open to a takings claim, because if you're taking away the value of those mineral rights and royalties, then without providing compensation, it's a taking, right? So interesting to see how this develops, Justin, but you know, certainly they're not in favor of oil and gas development. That's one thing for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that that's very obvious. And one of the lines in here mentioned that there was a vote that was done with the population of Fort Collins. 55% of voters supported a five-year moratorium on fracking. So, and that was as of 2013. So it's not unpopular with population there either.
Yeah, that's true. Well, shifting gears a little bit and talking about something a little more positive is, you know, the idea of pore space. And this particular article says, PA landowners have dealt with coal, oil, and gas rights. Now there are pore rights. State is among a handful that are working on laws for how carbon is captured and stored underground. And this particular article talks about Pennsylvania looking to set themselves up as a leader in the next generation of carbon capture and sequestration and carbon reduction, you know, carbon emissions reduction. And specifically, what they're looking at is putting legislation in place that would address pore ownership and liability for stored carbon. And that's looking to be introduced here in the next couple of weeks. And what they're looking to do is follow similar laws that were enacted in Nebraska last year, and then also in West Virginia. And then there's also laws in place in Wyoming, North Dakota, and Montana. And so they see the opportunity with Pennsylvania having very plentiful natural gas reserves and looking at how do we leverage that with, you know, clean hydrogen production, carbon sequestration associated with that. And so I think it's a, you know, pretty cool to see, you know, in terms of setting up the law to allow this type of technology to be utilized. So I think it's setting the stage. Obviously, it has to be economic for it to work out, and it has to really make sense, I think, from an energy standpoint. But, you know, good to see that they're setting this up, Justin. What was your take?
Yeah, I think it's very interesting to see them put in the infrastructure that's going to be required to let this happen. And this seems like a really ambitious project, but time will tell whether, like you said, if this is something that's really can be economical and can make money. You know, the article mentions that there's apprehension in both ways. You know, people are really excited about the billions of dollars of investment that could go into this. And then some people are really unsure if this is going to be economical or if Pennsylvania is really the place for it. So interested to follow the story and see how it goes.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it goes. I think the interesting thing about this, and we've talked about it on the show before, and we'll link to those other articles in the show notes, but this concept of pore space being owned by the surface owner. So this is something where the space under the ground is owned by the surface owner, but the stuff under the ground that's stored in that space is actually owned by whoever, you know, put it there. So for example, in a carbon sequestration project, the actual pore space belongs to the landowner. That CO2 belongs to whoever's sequestering it. So they're making that, you know, clear, and they're not changing that standard for who, you know, owns that and then what's the fair price for pore space. But I think that the interesting thing that this will open up is if it does, if this technology does move forward, it sort of sets the stage to identify who's liable for what around carbon capture and sequestration. And then I think once you have the legal framework outlined, then companies will be more comfortable investing, you know, the millions and billions of dollars that are going to be required on these large projects to move forward if they know that there are certain rules in place and how to work within those rules. And then, but it does open up an opportunity, I think, for, you know, in this case, landowners in Pennsylvania, as well as those other states that I think that are, have been proactive about this in terms of leasing your pore rights. So it'd be really interesting to hear about activity popping up with leasing for pore space. And that's just another opportunity, you know, around private land ownership, like we talked about. And I think this is the the clean energy and, you know, carbon capture version of the innovation that we saw around hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling like we just talked about. So kind of cool to see.
Yep, very cool to see. And kudos to the Pennsylvania lawmakers that have been working on this.
Absolutely.
All right, Matt, our next story here is, why is U.S. oil companies aren't riding to Europe's rescue? And, you know, this is something that we talked about a little bit when we got into the Senate hearing with the oil companies. But there's a lot of questions around why the United States oil companies aren't scaling up production to be able to aid the rest of the world who is trying to replace Russian gas or oil. So the article goes on to say here, production of U.S. energy companies is essentially flat and unlikely to increase substantially for at least another year or two. If Europe stops buying Russian oil and natural gas, as some of its leaders have promised, they won't be able to replace energy with fuels from the United States anytime soon. And Matt, it goes on to say that production is up less than 2% to 11.8 barrels since December and remains well below the record 13.1 million barrels a day set in March 2020, just before the pandemic paralyzed the economy. There are a lot of factors going into this, Matt. This isn't just as simple as it seems. And though I think oil companies would like to take advantage of the higher oil and gas prices, it also puts them in a very risky situation to overextend themselves.
I think you hit the nail on the head right there. And there's a quote from Jim Crane, who's at Bryce University, saying, and now they could be leaping into action to pitch in to bring much needed oil to the world. They're being uncharacteristically cautious. Well, Jim, you know, if you've worked in the industry like I have, you know, there was a reason now, you know, we've finally learned our lesson, I think, and are being cautious. Part of it's because there's been such amount of rhetoric coming from Washington, D.C. and also in the investment community around divesting from oil and gas and investing in clean energy. And so certainly, I think that is playing into this in terms of companies' abilities to attract capital that is needed to reinvest, to drill new wells, and to grow production. So, and the other thing too is, you know, companies are gun shy a little bit. They're hearing on one hand, the Biden administration saying they're going to stop the oil and gas industry. It'll be it. You guys are done. And then now they're saying, well, you guys need to increase production. It's like, well, you can't have your cake and eat it too. You know, which do you want? And so what they've been hearing for the past couple of years is that we're moving away from oil and gas. They're not going to invest in the infrastructure that's required. You know, if you think about growing oil and gas, it's not just drilling the well and then magically that oil appears on the market. You have millions of dollars of infrastructure that has to be built. And that, you know, takes years to pay back. And if they're is a high degree of uncertainty around companies' abilities to, you know, repay that investment, then they're not going to make it, you know, pure and simple. So I think that's a lot of what's playing into it. Now, certainly with oil prices near $100 a barrel, companies are generating a lot of cash that they ought to be reinvesting into drilling new wells and growing production within reason. You know, the other thing that we got into is the fact that the companies have finally realized that they have to live within their balance sheet. You know, both investors are demanding it, as well as, you know, they don't want to go out of business and declare bankruptcy again. So I think that we're finally in a position where the economic health of the industry is good, and we want it to stay that way. That means a slower rate of growth than we saw during the shale revolution, and because companies were investing more money than they were bringing in from selling the oil and gas. And so that was not a sustainable path. And so now we're on a more sustainable path. That means slower growth. You know, I think that also you have the recent memory of the prices going negative in 2020. And so I think we're also worried a little bit that if we grow production too fast, that prices will tank again. You might get an issue with OPEC, you know, flooding the market with barrels, or a deal with Iran bringing new barrels on and dropping prices. And I think too that the global economic situation is not looking good. We're, I think, in the position of being stagnant from a growth standpoint. So as the demand for oil and gas goes down with economic slowdowns, you know, for whatever reason, we're going to be in a position where there's a lot of downward pressure on oil prices. So I think all of those things together are causing some trepidation within the industry to go and, you know, start drilling a bunch of wells. But I do think, like we talked about in that hearing episode, where we mentioned that companies ought to be spending more on growing production to the extent that they can within the resource constraints that they have, because it's very clear that we are limited by skilled labor out there that can actually go and drill these additional wells for the material, like the steel and the pipe and all that stuff, that we just don't have, you know, endless supply of that. So we're kind of constrained from a supply standpoint. I mean, supply from materials like sand, pipe, and then services like labor and things like that. So I think that is really what's holding us back right now, are those more than anything. But, you know, I think even when we do grow production, it's going to be a lot slower rate than we've seen in the past, Justin.
And I think, like you were mentioning, to keep the industry stable, that's certainly not a bad thing. And, you know, the article here mentions that even if the larger oil companies wanted to invest more and take on these large projects, Wall Street isn't really keen on investing in these projects because of the push with the renewables and the uncertainty with the oil and gas prices. And as you mentioned, oil and gas prices being high where they are, I think there's a lot of interpretation that they've got nowhere to go but down.
Yep, I think you're right. So lots to take into account here. You know, I think we'll be in a situation where we are going to grow very slowly, but unfortunately, we have a very acute need to export more oil, or an acute opportunity to export more oil to Europe to help offset the pressures, you know, to buy oil from Russia, where maybe they don't want to, but they sort of have to, which we saw, I think, recently with natural gas and you know, for companies having to pay rubles for natural gas because they just absolutely need it. There's really no way around it. There's no other alternative. So, you know, it'd be good to see us being able to export more oil. But I think in order to be able to export more oil to support Europe, we need to grow enough to where we can meet our domestic needs, because I think that needs to come first, obviously. But yeah, it's a tough situation, but, you know, good to hear that we're not going crazy again and putting the economic health of the industry at risk this time.
Couldn't agree more, Matt. And on that note, do you want to talk about the rig count?
Let's do it. Yeah. So the rig count, and kind of related to that production growth, we're just kind of monitoring the rig count here in North America, and we're seeing, you know, pretty flat, really. I think we're even. We're at 796 rigs in North America, 695 of those in the U.S. That's a change of 2 for the U.S., and they're all land rigs that were added. And, you know, if you look at the actual summary by states, it looks like we lost one in Wyoming, gained one in Alaska, and then gained 2 in North Dakota. So, you know, minor uptick, but, you know, again, we're not seeing a massive shift like we're reading in these articles. You know, we're seeing slight upticks. You know, certainly there are, the number of rigs is not the limiting factor. It's the stuff that those rigs use and the people to run those rigs that are holding us back. So
couldn't agree more. Yeah, it'd be interesting to see if we start to see some growth. And, you know, I think it's going to take some effort on the administration's part to really get these companies going on exports of natural gas, if that's going to be something that the, you know, there's a lot of talk right now about helping European states to replace that Russian natural gas. So it'd be interesting to see what changes there.
Yeah, it will be interesting. You know, we're in a good position. You know, we're growing LNG export capacity, and so that's going to continue. But again, those are multi-year projects as well. So it's going to take time. So, well, that is all for this month's news. And if you have any questions, or if you come across any articles you want us to feature in an upcoming episode, you can email us at feedback@mineralrightspodcast.com. If you could do us a huge favor and help us out, leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening to this, it would be greatly appreciated. Thanks again, and we'll talk to you next time. Thanks, Justin.
Thanks, Matt.
Thanks so much for listening to the Mineral Rights Podcast with your host, Matt Sands. Don't forget to subscribe and share at mineralrightspodcast.com. The Mineral Rights Podcast should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy.